Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dalkey Archive Press's Black on White. In this week's episode, Jean-Jacques Pousset, Warren Mahdi, and John O'Brien discuss Jacques Ribault's book, Something Black.
Well, our new guest is Jean-Jacques Pousset, who wrote a dissertation on Jacques Ribault, and who published a book on Jacques Ribault, and who is a broadly recognized international specialist on Jacques Ribault. And we're lucky to have him here because he's going to share with us some of his insights on Jacques Ribault's work. And I think today we're talking about his poetry, in the first instance at least, right? And perhaps Something Black. Is that the case?
So my understanding is that the book of poetry that we're speaking about is Quelque Chose Noir, which was translated as Something Black. One of Jacques Ribault's perhaps most well-known works of poetry. And in many ways, it stands out from all of the works of poetry from that era of French poetry. But I think it also stands out from among other works of Ribault's poetry. It is a one-off. It is a singular work of poetry that is occasioned by the early death of his wife, Alix Cléo Ribault, who had been married with Jacques for a short time before succumbing to a long illness related to asthma, from what the best understanding is. And as readers will quickly find out, the journal years of writing leading up to the end of her life, Alix Cléo, were also published by Ribault and translated and published by John.
Jean-Jacques, in order to contextualize this, what you call a singular work of poetry, a little bit more, would you talk a little bit about the tradition of elegy in French literature, and more particularly still the tradition of elegy to which Ribault himself appears and in which he takes his stand as he publishes this work?
Yeah, well, I think that there's a couple of initial things to say about elegy in French literature. The first being that it is a personal, often a very personal work, but it can also be a public work. So certainly in traditional, or let's say 17th century and 18th century and 15th century poetry, elegies can be written for public figures, and they have a function of helping or officializing a discourse of mourning and replacement. That is certainly not the case here. I think another general thing to say about elegies is that after World War II, the poetic discourse in France becomes highly elegiacal. And the problem of mourning, or the problem of facing loss and responsibility and loss, is permeates the poetic discourse, and certainly heavily between 45 and 70. But this work very much stands apart from some of the dominant gestures that we find in elegies, whether they're in English or in other languages, in that it doesn't comfort itself. It doesn't provide any kind of comfort, especially through forms of constellation or there's no attempt to reify the lost person. There's no attempt to make of Alix a saint. There's a very clear, meditative attention to the present of loss. And as readers will find in Quelque Chose Noir, it is only written after Ribault keeps about 30 months of silence. So Alix passes, I think, in 83. So, and then the book Something Black begins with a date, And that date is marking the end of 30 months of quietude, of also probably work, but at the same time, one of the poems in the collection says that during this period he has a hard time entering the lyric mode of language, and in fact probably heavily is reading Genji and Lancelot, and investing a lot of his creative and energy into the prose work that comes about.
No, yes, I noticed that part in the poem. In the second part of the poem, he says, I can't open a single book of poetry, he says. And and he says also, I'm reading inoffensive prose. So all of a sudden, he produces this work of poetry, which puts poetry itself into question.
Yeah.
Right, don't you think?
Yeah.
He's writing, in a sense, against poetry in this Jean-Jacques.
Against a certain kind of poetry, yes. I'd say that's right. But I'd say that that there are other works of poetry that have appeared prior to Something Black, written mostly by friends of Roubaud's, Claude Royer-Journoux, Claude Royer-Journoux's partner for a long time, who's and also friends of the Waldrops, who also have eschewed poetry that's based on metaphor. I think that's an important element to stage if we're going to talk about Something Black as contrary to a poetic discourse. But also, like, every single poem that's a very interesting poem after 1961 is a poem that is, going against the poetic tradition. Denis Roche, for example, is absolutely anti-poet. So, in many ways, we can already say that's true about Rimbaud or other earlier poets. So, I would say that another way of saying that, Warren, is to talk about this book of poems as a poem that's agrammatical, or a poem that seeks to undermine some of the grammar of poems. And that would both deal with grammar of language, but also deal with lyrical discourse.
Let's talk more particularly, Jean-Jacques. I'd like to invite you to speak a little more particularly about the relation to metaphor. One of the principal metaphors in the French tradition of elegy, I think, is the tombeau, the tomb or the grave, right? So I'm thinking of Mallarmé most particularly. Le tombeau d'Edgar Poe, the tomb of Edgar Poe, or the tomb of Charles Baudelaire that he writes. What's Roubaud's position with regard to that specific Mallarméan tradition of elegy, insisting on the poem itself as the tomb?
First of all, I think that those two examples belong to a public form of elegy, in that we have with the tombeau de Edgar Poe or Baudelaire a poet who's writing in praise of and up against another poet, whose reading of the other poet is also a kind of in a Bloomian sense, a way of embodying and perhaps not doing a battle with, at least dealing with the poet. And in this case, with Something Black, we're dealing with a much more personal, much a more internal conversation. Also, I think, important to say about the tombeau tradition, that's a tradition that Roubaud engages with and has long engaged with in numerous ways. Some of them being in scholastic ways. He's somebody who's been very attentive and insistent on understanding developments in form, especially through the sonnet, but other forms across centuries in France and English and other languages, Spanish. That's been a way to, I've not dominate, then at least become a very clear authority on those forms. But I also think that, for example, he wrote a very beautiful poem called Le Tombeau de Pétrarque, which is an exercise in the tombeau as a public form, where he takes the nine Sistinas that are in Petrarch, and he re-establishes them, builds a poem out of them, and makes a poem of poems. And in many ways, that's one of the ways in which Rubeau is a very powerful poet, is that he makes of other poems, of other poets, the source matter for his poetry. In this case, and this is one of the reasons why Quelque chose noir stands so much apart, all of Rubeau's poetry, especially the poetry published in the Collection Blanche at Gallimard, belongs to his Projet de Poésie, all of it except Quelque chose noir. Quelque chose noir is unforeseeable. It's something that he could not have thought about when he invented the projet. And in many ways, it changes the projet, but it's a poem that doesn't belong to a synthetic group of poems. However, like all the other books of poems, Quelque chose noir is not a collection of individual poems. It is a book of poems that's conceived on the same as a synthetic book, as one entire collection that makes sense. Nine sections of nine poems, each with nine lines or something like lines for each of the poems. And the building on the number nine, which also sounds like the adjective new in French, neuf, is, I think, connects this poem to other tombeaux. Since the tombeau, in fact, is, I'd say, related to "The King is Dead, Long Live the King." It's a performance, a verbal performance that is intended to add some consolation, of which we are denied in Quelque chose noir. One thing I'd say, just in terms of an image, at the very opening of the book, there is something black, right? In the first poem, which is a fond de Guinness, the last traces of the bottom of a bottle of or glass of Guinness, which is the image that Rubeau uses to talk about the way blood has accumulated in the finger of the corpse of his beloved. And that is the first mark of blackness, of dark, of black. And in a way, that we could talk about how blackness is then transmogrified into ink or into him waking up in the darkness. But I also think that there's something very specific about him wanting to pay attention to the body of the deceased and also the absence of the deceased at the same time. So the humanity has already gone from her.
Could one of you read it in French? We're talking about it, but I think it'd be useful if one of you read it, and then I will do my best with the English.
Méditation du 12 décembre 1985. Je me trouvais devant ce silence inarticulé, un peu comme le bois. Certains, en de semblables mêmes moments, ont pensé déchiffrer l'esprit dans quelques rémanences. Cela fut pour eux une consolation ou du redoublement de l'horreur. Pas moi. Il y avait du sang lourd sous ta peau, dans ta main, tombé au bout des doigts. Je ne le voyais pas humain. Cette image se présente pour la millième fois, à neuf, avec la même violence. Elle ne peut pas ne pas se répéter indéfiniment. Une nouvelle génération de mes cellules, si tant il y a, trouvera cette duplication onéreuse. Ces tirages photographiques internes, je n'ai pas le choix, maintenant. Rien ne m'influence dans la noirceur. Je ne m'exerce à aucune comparaison. Je n'avance aucune hypothèse. Je m'enfonce par les ongles. Je suis, de temps, myope. On ne peut pas me dire « Regarde cette herbe là-bas, 10 ans en avant, va dans sa direction. » Le regard humain a le pouvoir de donner de la valeur aux êtres. Cela les rend plus coûteux. On ne peut pas me dire « Parle et attends une seule chose de la parole. » Elle ne sera pas pensée. Voilà le bout. Le bout où il n'y a aucune vérité, qu'une palme de feuilles en espace, avec ses encombrements.
Why don't you read the English, John?
There, before this silence, inarticulate, a little like wood, some, in moments like this, thought they could decipher some residue of spirit. It was a consolation for them, or a double horror, not for me. Heavy blood under your skin, in your hand, sunk to the fingertips. I couldn't see it as human. This image again, for the thousandth time, with the same violence, can't help replaying forever. My next generation of cells, if there's time, will find this duplication tiresome. These inner photo prints, I have no choice now. Nothing can get to me in the dark. I don't try to compare. I don't offer hypotheses. I hang on by my nails. I live in nearsighted times. Don't tell me, look at the grass, over there, 10 years hence, that way. The human eye has the power to give value to beings. It makes them cost more. You can't tell me, go on, talk, just don't expect too much from words. They won't be thoughts. This is the end. The end where there is no truth, except for leaves fanning out into space and its clutter.
Well, John, I was going to say that you brought up a very good point about how the poems present themselves on the page, and that in fact they're the lines themselves, insofar as they are lines, are composed of fragments of sentences. And some of them, the fragments are separated, or the words are separated by space, and at times they're separated by periods. And in many ways, just for the reader, the first time coming through, this certainly interrupts the regular grammar of a sentence. It draws attention to something else going on. And for those like me who have read a lot of Roubaud, it also connects to two or three things. One of them is that the areas where there's periods directly after the fragments, that is a direct evocation of the way in which Alix wrote her journal, and that Dalkey has nicely reproduced in the journal version. That is, there are fragments, a period, and then the continuation of the fragment, no space between the period. And something has to, I think, in that case, has to do with her not being able to breathe, or something. Their breath is interrupted there, or forced in Alix's journal. And then I guess the other thing I wanted to say, another place in Roubaud's work where that type of poem presentation represents itself or reproduces itself is in his translation of troubadour poems that are also in the on the page, interrupted, or often in criticism or in other ways. We do a line and a slash and a line slash, where that slash tells you you're starting a new line, and the period or the space works, that does that same type of operation, but differently and in a varied way throughout
the Jean-Jacques, it also strikes me that sort of fundamental principle of interruption is very, very important here. Mm-hmm. In some sense, you mentioned that this kind of interrupts his poetic project. He couldn't foresee mm-hmm. this, and it stands out as being very anomalous within his sort of set of poetic principles and manners of carrying out his poetry as an oeuvre. It seems to me that he plays upon, in a very sober manner, that he plays upon the principle of interruption on a variety of levels in this book. Mm. I mean, even on the level of the gestalt, you know, the reader opening this book will see a very, very interrupted text, interrupted paradoxically by whiteness, right? By blankness, mm. by emptiness, rather than by black. It's the black that is interrupted by the white spaces, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of a questioning of black and white, of emptiness and fullness and so forth and so on. I wonder if you agree. And I'd also like to invite you to talk about the way that he borrows his very title from Alix, whose collection of photographs was entitled If Something Black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. So there's a lot to say there. I think on the one hand, the interruption of space, or the marking of light in a way, you know, is something that he's borrowing from photography and also from the dominant visual aspect of poetic language. And certainly throughout this, he's avoiding images, but images come anyway. At the end of the first poem we've just read, we've found a palm tree, and the palm is the hand, is the drop of Guinness at the bottom of the finger. So as much as there's an interruption of even meaning, or of arrival at meaning in the poems, the language works differently than the photography themselves. So I think readers who discover the journal will understand that Alix, as many poets, spent enormous amount of time and energy thinking about her death and photographing the struggle of life, and in fact the process of breath. And in fact, I think that that's all by itself a really interesting artistic game, and one that she was thinking through while studying or reading Wittgenstein. And there are some really great studies about the relationship between Alix and photography and philosophy. One of them by Hélène Giacchinecchini. Do you know how to say that more? Giacchinecchini, yeah. Right. And I think that Roubaud would have liked for the Gallimard to publish, along with Something Black, the series of photography, of photographs that Alix had done. It's a collection of photographs that she had done with Roubaud in their state of biopsism, as he likes to put it, which I think is a term that relates to creative love. That he would have liked that to be published in France, and the Collection Blanche is, I don't know, sober in many ways, and I was very thrilled as a graduate student to see that that John, you had taken the pains to publish that series of photographs with Rosemary Waldrop's translations. That was very useful, and in fact, it was one of the very first places that any reader of Roubaud could find them easily. John, do you want to tell us how that came to be, the inclusion of the photographs with the translation?
Yes. Jacques asked me if I would consider including them, and I don't know if he told me that he'd had trouble with the edition in France or not. And I told him, as I do, at least certain of our writers, I'll do the book however you want it done. And so he said, I'll send you, you know, copies of the photos, and he did. And of course, they were just perfect for the book. And so much compliment what he has written in the first part. So that was the decision. Then I worried about how much would it cost to reproduce these, and whatever it is. They belonged here. There was no doubt about it. They weren't just like lovely photos, and shouldn't we have it in a book because they were hers. They are part of this book, and I think inseparable from it. I wasn't going to jump to something else, but there's so many of these poems that will continue with a image from other poems. And I should also add this. I once had the bright idea, wonderful idea, of reading some of these in a class. I can't remember what the class might have been about. Maybe I just felt like reading these one day. And after the first one or two, I realized that I was crying. That's how powerful these are. And so I had to stop. I mean, there's no way that I was going to be able to get through reading more than the first maybe one or two that I read. And that's how they can continue to affect me. And I don't know of any other attempt at writing an entire book that is about the aftermath of a death and what it is one sees, how one remembers, which I think is in fragments, images of the past. And this entire book is really, in some sense, it's about loss and how that loss continues. It doesn't go away. And yet, people who are left with it, you know, you're given only so much time in which you can.
Yes, how can we talk about mourning when there's a gorgeous little girl chatting in the background? That's what consoles us, right? Yeah, that's a consoling feature. You know, it strikes me that one reads this book, or one can read this book, very much doubly. On the one hand, you read it as an evocation of Alix Cléo-Robeau as an artist, the person who she was, and then on the other hand, you read it as a kind of a journal of mourning of the way that Jacques Robeau engages in mourning. I won't say the work of mourning, because that Freudian term is I think very misleading. It suggests that everybody's got to work through mourning and come out the other side with their psyche precisely intact and functional the way it was before the loved person disappeared. I think it's very tyrannical and counterproductive. But the process of mourning is very much on display here, I think, as a daily sort of exercise or kind of discipline, in a sense. Do you agree, Jean-Jacques?
I do. I think that we could also, if that were the dark side of things, we could flip it to the light side. And I think that there's also here a process of living. And that one way of talking about that is, you mentioned something, Black, the series. When in the Dalkey Archive series, it's dated 1980. 1980 is the year that Jacques and Alix are married. And the series of photographs are extraordinary and experimental. They're black and white photographs that represent the photographer in self-portraiture, often in a in the nude, in a room with limited light, and often in double or triple or quadruple exposure, so you see the figure four or five times. And in many ways, each picture is the representation of the artist representing themselves, or representing the memory of themselves, or representing the movement of themselves through the world. And that there's a consciousness about living. And in one of the poems, or one of the photos, or several of the photos, there's a reproduction at the center of a picture of Alix as a child. So there's this also distance, this reframing of her thinking about herself as a child, growing up, and thinking about her life as an artist. And in the final one, she's laying down upon Roubaud as if assuming a position on a tomb, or in a position of lovemaking. And that Thanatos and Eros combined there, I think, would do the other thing, which is talk about this is a process of loving, of living and loving. And part of the reason why Roubaud waits for the 30 months to go by is related to, I think, a way that he works his way through, which is often about numbers or about structures. So the palindrome of they had been living together for 30 months, there had been in that apartment for 30 months, waiting, with that 30 months of presence to have to somehow subside before then writing.
Could you read another one, Jean? English title is Desolation Reigned in My Heart.
Got it. Yeah. En moi régnait la désolation. En moi régnait la désolation. Où ton existence était si forte, elle était devenue forme d'être. En moi régnait la désolation, comme conversant à voix basse. Mais les paroles n'avaient pas la force de franchir seulement, car il n'y avait pas quoi. On se tourne vers le monde, on se tourne vers soi. On voudrait n'habiter aucunement. C'est le noyau habituel de l'uniforme, de l'infortune. C'est le noyau habituel de l'infortune. Vous étiez notre mode d'adresse. L'avez été. Morte, je ne pouvais plus dire que tu. Yeah, that I think that's one of the things about this poem that's amazing is that shift from the formal form vous, which in between the lovers became a game, and then tu, which is the informal you in French, and that also sounds like the word mute or quieted.
Where your non-existence was so strong, it had become a form of being. Desolation reigned in my heart, as if talking in whispers. But the words not strong enough to come across simply. There was no what to cross. We turn toward the world, turn toward ourselves. We would prefer not to inhabit the common core of misfortune. We were formal with each other, had been. Is he dead? I can only be familiar too.
I think one thing we can say about these poems, Warren has already mentioned that it's a very sober approach to the process of writing an elegy. But I also think it's an extremely honest one. And part of that honesty is just to brutally talk about death, just to say, with you dead. You know, and which I think is It is part of the work of mourning. It's part of the, just the acceptance, the coming to terms with the body, or the loss, and separating the existence from the non-existence. And another thing that I would say just about that poem is, Warren, you were talking about how there's all this interruption, and there's the writing of the space or the blankness or the whiteness that interrupts the darkness or the blackness of writing. But here, what's like eminently present, what's overwhelmingly present, is non-existence. You know, and the non-existence that inhabits the space.
I agree. And there's that tension too between, how should I put it, between that elegiac tradition that goes so deeply into, you know, the history of poetry, the sort of the Orphic tradition as well. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Of which he's abundantly aware. And this kind of new way of not resorting to metaphor, or not conspicuously resorting to metaphor, nor to embellishment, nor to, you know, a style that has particular graspable sort of features to it, sort of an undifferentiated style. He's looking at the fact of his lover's death full on, refusing to look away from it, and talking about it for us in ways that encourage us to think about death no holds barred as well, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And you know Hulbeau better than I do, Jean-Jacques, but it would seem to me that kind of frankness is one of the hallmarks of his work. You used the word honesty, I think, a moment ago. And I think that's one of his salient characteristics as a writer.
Yeah, I mean, it's often, you know, a kind of also a childlike naivete that traverses his whole work, from his criticism to his fiction to his poetry, also a kind of unabashed aggressive curiosity to look at the world as it is, or to see words for what they are. But one of the things that we just came upon in that last poem, in the English, it was, but the words not strong enough to come across. In many ways, that's one of the standard things. That's one of the cliches of what we say, and what poets say when it comes to talking about the loss of somebody. You know, we say condolences and there are no words. But I think that he's going a lot further than that here. And in working with, in conversing with Claude Voyageurnaud and Anne-Marie Albiac, an agrammatical approach to meaning, one that is, I think, also evoked in some of the language poets in the American postmodern or contemporary scene. He's trying to get words to do something different, or he's giving space, he's allowing words, he's breaking up discourse so that words can take place on the page without arriving at a place that is inauthentic. And I think that's really partially the intention of agrammaticality. And also, I think there are, for some of the poets who are working in that vein, political reasons for that. When words necessarily come to a closure or to an end, the aesthetic pleasure or the aesthetic intention somehow gets betrayed.
John, you mentioned that this work came over the transom, as it were. You know that Rosemary Waldrop just sort of sent it into you. I have tremendous admiration for her as a poet and as a translator. She, you know, I've worked a lot on Edmond Jabès, and she translated almost all of Jabès superbly well. It was a task that I wouldn't have wanted to even begin to consider, but her translations are just limpid. They're just wonderful. I think that probably you, John, were ready to see this because you had very early on committed, Dalkey to publishing Hubo. I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the first Hubo text that you published was the first volume of The Great Fire of London that Dominic Di Bernardi translated. Was that it?
I think that came after. I sought to get his Hortense novels, the rights to those, which are, these great comic novels that he wrote. And in the midst of all that, I think something black came in at that time, and that was followed by Great Fire.
I'm sitting here with the uncorrected, the advance uncorrected galley for the Great Fire of London, and that's dated 1989. But then it's due for a final publication date of 1991, and Something Black came out in 1990. So I guess that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk about Hubo's place in the Dalkey catalog, John?
That's one of the hard questions. I don't know what any of the books are doing there, and I get asked all the time. There was an interview with a really brilliant interviewer for the Los Angeles Times, an interview with me, and she raised this question, what makes a Dalkey book? I thought, I have no idea. And I said, I begin reading and I love it. And apparently there's something that runs through many of them, if not all of them, that...
In one of the interviews, you said that one of the qualities of Dalkey books that Dalkey books seem to share is a subversive quality, it seems to me, right?
Well, that came out of a conversation with Steve Moore as we were trying to figure out a way of describing what is it that we're up to. And what I think he may have used the word, I perhaps used several words when he came up with the word subversive. And the idea of it was any press that's entirely devoted to publishing only what it believes is excellence is subversive in our culture. The motivation was not sales. The motivation wasn't gaining some kind of recognition and fame. It was doing what was necessary to do because it was important. And so I think it was Steve who volunteered. We're very political in that sense. We're subversive. And I thought, yes, I'm not intending to be, but I think, in fact, we are, because there really wasn't a press quite like it, except Sun and Moon was similar. And then, of course, New Directions came before us and was such a big influence. But to just say the books are going to be chosen on the basis of their excellence, and then, of course, it fell to me usually to decide which those books were. But why would there this similarity? As I say, we take years of therapy, which I'm not interested in, to be figuring that one out. Because death seems to roam around in so many of them. And then this very strange sense of humor that you find in Flann O'Brien. You couple those two things and it kind of describes something. But I've never tried to, and some people have really not just urged me to, but to challenge me to describe the aesthetic of the press. And I don't want to do it. I just proceed in the way that I do. And it's not that I'm incapable of standing back and coming up with something that might be reasonable. But I don't know. I don't want to know why. Some books just I find incredibly funny or incredibly sad, and frequently a mixture of the two. With Rabot, I've described how moving I think this is. With something like Great Fire of London, it's an enormous project that he set out for himself, and the complications of it all, and the engagement of being able to work with his plan of, I believe it was seven books, that would constitute the entire project fascinated me. And I could read Rabot, any of the material that would come in, you know, translated, just read and be so compelled to go on and keep turning the pages, even though so many of them are highly fragmented. He did not believe in the well-made novel, let's say. The whatever he decided was now going to be the subject of some particular chapter, that's what it would become. And yet it, of course, all fit together in the end.
I would I'd be glad to just say one thing about why this is a really good and interesting moment to be thinking about Rabot, these books, and also the timeline that you had just evoked in the way in which Dalkey published his work. If the Hortense novels and Quelque Chose Noir and The Great Fire of London were the first moment of Rabot's coming into English, those all of those works belong to ongoing, either abandoned or transformed projects that now have come to something like a full fruition. And the turning back and looking at a lot of the ways in which the projects have changed and the works have evolved, how they've been received, how they will be received, that work is before us now. It's a really interesting time to be thinking and talking about Rabot. I'd say that. And also, I'd say that the two books that we are beginning to talk about today, Something Black and the first branch of the arborescent prose known as The Great Fire of London, they're so intertwined and they're so interconnected that it makes for some deep confusion. And the kind of confusion that you just evoked as a positive aspect of Dalkey Archive Press. And I think that deep wood, as you would have it, is not yet going to be completely clarified, but it's a good time just to take an exploration through that forest.
I agree, and I would only add that when you were talking about confusion as being a powerful driver of the readerly experience, Jean-Jacques, I couldn't help thinking about Flann O'Brien, whom I have read in very, very delightful confusion. Very delightful confusion. I understand why Dalkey Archive Press is called Dalkey Archive Press.
Thank you for tuning in to Dalkey Archive Press's Black on White. If you enjoyed this week's episode, be sure to tune in next week, where John O'Brien, Warren Motti, and Jean-Jacques Pousset will be discussing Jacques Rabot's follow-up to Something Black, The Great Fire of London, also available via Dalkey Archive Press.